Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Grok Radio. The following broadcast is made possible by the friends and partners of CYI Worldwide Ministries and Grok Radio. And the views expressed in this program and by our guests may not necessarily reflect those of CYI Worldwide Ministries or its staff. And now, enjoy the show.
You stand on the shore of the ocean watching the tide come in. You sense the call of the sea beckoning to take you in further. You step forward little by little, not knowing what to expect, but expecting more. You keep going as the ocean calls you to enter in to deeper waters.
Hello, everyone. I'm Nick Peters. I am the host of the Deeper Waters podcast, and I'd like to give an update about today's show. We were hoping to have Mike Lacona on here and talk about the resurrection of Jesus, but he's kind of had a family crisis. His mother right now is in very bad health and kind of expecting that, barring a miracle, she'll be in the manifest presence of Jesus soon. So I ask for your prayers greatly in this time, as it's being very hard on my family, and I know my own spouse is taking it incredibly difficult. So we definitely do covet your prayers this time. But I am very thankful that my guest today, Dr. James Hannum, agreed to join us on such a short notice to talk about his book, God's Philosophers, also known as The Genesis of Science, where we'll be discussing science in the medieval period. Dr. Hannum, good to have you with us.
Hello, Nick. Good to be on the show.
Thank you for coming on such short notice. Now, my listeners might not know much about you, so the opening question I usually ask my guest is, tell us who you are and why you think my listeners should listen to what you have to say today.
Well, as you can probably tell from my accent, I'm from England.
Mm-hmm.
I am professionally, I suppose, an accountant, but I also have studied history. I have a PhD in history of science from Cambridge. And I wrote a book, God's Philosophers, as you kindly mentioned just now, published in the United States under the name of Genesis of Science. And that book is really intended to explain that the Middle Ages were a period of great importance as far as science was concerned. I got into this because, I would say about 15 years ago, I decided, having been brought up as a Christian but sort of fallen away from the faith during my teens and 20s, that I would properly explore Christianity. And as I had a physics degree, the relationship between science and religion was something which I was actually quite worried about. And so I decided that that was something I was going to have to investigate especially closely, because I was concerned that I had heard that Christianity had been an enemy of science, that it had held back scientific advance. And as someone who was trained in science, this was something which would have been a big black mark against Christianity had it been true.
Mm-hmm.
And I found, in fact, it wasn't the case at all. And as I dug deeper, especially into historical materials and reading the work of scholars and historians like Edward Grant and David Lindbergh, I found that, in fact, it seems that Christianity has been historically a friend of science. And even in that rather notorious period, the Middle Ages, where people imagined that Christianity was dominating the scene to the extent that there was no other kind of progress in any other field of thought, even in that period, science was flourishing, and Christianity was one of the reasons for that flourishing. Christianity was a friend of science. And I thought this was absolutely amazing, because it was totally the opposite of everything I'd ever heard, everything I'd ever believed and been taught. And I thought there's a real important story here that's just got to be got out to people who aren't familiar with the scholarship, to general readers and to ordinary Christians. And so that's why I wrote the book that I did, not as a book of apologetics, but a book of straightforward history that tells the truth about what historians now know about the Middle Ages.
Now, if I was to sum up the modern idea usually that we might get from writers like the New Atheists and such, it'd be that there was a great increase of knowledge starting with, let's say, Thales of Miletus, where philosophy started, and then you have people like Plato and Aristotle who carry on this grand tradition. There's even a bit of heliocentrism showing up, but then Christianity shows up and takes control, and we enter into the Dark Ages, where science just languishes under the iron fist of the church, and we're not delivered from it until Copernicus and Kepler and Galileo come along, who start showing the interest in science again and restore us to the powers of reason once more. Would you say that's an accurate description of a modern belief?
Well, I think that is accurate, and there's a really good illustration of that belief, which, of course, we now know to be wrong, but there's a really good illustration of that belief in Carl Sagan's book, Cosmos. And
yes.
In that book, there is a timeline of science, and he has all those things about the ancient Greeks that you mentioned, and then there's a thousand-year gap between 400 AD and Copernicus, where absolutely nothing happens, according to Carl Sagan, in the field of science. And that's a wholly false belief, but it certainly was very widely believed, and it's something that Carl Sagan thought that undoubtedly thought was true when he was writing that best-selling book.
There is atheist who's really kind of well known on the internet. I'm sure you're familiar from Tim O'Neill, who has a website and where he spends a lot of time defending your viewpoint and going after these people. And I've heard him speak about this chart that you can usually find on the internet where it shows the advancements of science and then there's the Dark Ages and says, imagine, we could have been flying in spaceships and going to other planets by now. And he's replied by saying that this is the stupidest thing on the internet ever. So this isn't a position just held by Christians, is it?
No, not at all. Tim, who I know reasonably well online, he's a very blunt-speaking Australian, says what he thinks, and although he is very much a non-believer, a very firm atheist, he has also studied history close enough to know that the traditional view that Christianity held back science is just complete and utter rubbish, and he's been brave enough to put that point across quite forcibly to his fellow atheists.
Now, I'd like to remind our listeners before we're going any further that if you have a question that you would like to ask Dr. Hannum about science, if you want to challenge him even on this point, then the call-in number is 714-242-5180, and I will be repeating this throughout the show because we would love to get a lot of good callers on this topic. So maybe we should go back to the beginning. Was it really the case that Greeks were doing science? Right now I'm reading, for instance, David Bentley Hart's book, Atheist Delusions, where he says that none of the Greeks really were sitting down doing what we would call science today. They were doing more philosophy under the guise of science. What would you say the Greeks were doing?
Well, I think that's true. I think what the Greeks were doing is well described as natural philosophy, the philosophy of nature. And it wasn't experimental science. It wasn't like modern science. It was scientific in the sense that it was essentially a rational inquiry, and it was an inquiry about how the world worked. But it wasn't based on experiments. It wasn't based on hypotheses and testing those hypotheses. To a very great extent, it wasn't mathematical in the way that modern science is, although they did, of course, use geometry to describe the way that the planets move. And the scientific method of the ancient Greeks was totally different to the modern scientific method. And the fact that they used this, they didn't use experiments, and they didn't test their hypotheses by doing controlled experiments was part of the reason that despite them making some very impressive suggestions, they didn't really make very much important scientific progress. Now, there's one good example of this that perhaps I could make. Aristotle, the most famous of the ancient Greek natural philosophers, believed that maggots appeared spontaneously in rotting meat. And the reason he believed this is whenever he saw a piece of rotting meat lying around, it had maggots in it, and he didn't see where those maggots were coming from. But he never carried out the experiment where he could have taken two pieces of meat, put one in a box, and left one out in the open. And they both would have rotted, of course, but the one in the box would not have produced any maggots because he would have kept the flies off. And because he never tried to carry out those sorts of controlled experiments, he was constantly making observations and drawing the wrong conclusions.
Now, if my history of science is correct, in fact, the first one who disproved that theory was Louis Pasteur, wasn't it?
Louis Pasteur was invented the bacterial theory of disease. That's right. Spontaneous mm-hmm. generation, of course, continued to be believed for centuries and centuries and centuries. But certainly, mm-hmm. as far as maggots were concerned, by the time of Louis Pasteur, people have been aware for ages that they were the larvae of flies.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we look back at the Greeks, stick and thin for a while, we can look at some of the things they did get right that also do prove a number of other atheist myths, such as, for instance, that the Greeks didn't hold that the earth was flat, and neither did the early church, for that matter. In fact, I think you've said in your work that it would be very hard to find an educated person who held the flat of the earth, who held that the earth was flat, if not impossible to find one.
Well, certainly the ancient Greeks had figured out that the Earth was a sphere by around about 450-400 BC, mm-hmm. and Western civilization has not actually doubted that fact since that time, which is something which mm-hmm. has been totally accepted for the last 2,500 years. And mm-hmm. medieval Christians were no different. They were perfectly aware that the Earth was a sphere. There's lots and lots of evidence for this. For instance, if you see a picture of a medieval king, you'll see that he's carrying a scepter and an orb as a symbol of his power. And the reason he's given an orb is it's a symbol of his power over the earth. But if, of course, people thought that the earth was flat, they'd have handed him a dinner plate rather than an orb.
There's actually a standing prize,
which was offered back in the 1950s for, I think, $50 or something, for anyone who could find an authentic person during the Middle Ages saying that the Earth is flat. $50 might have been quite a lot in the 50s. It's probably not worth a lot now, but needless to say, no one has ever been able to claim the prize. And there were one or two very early Christians in the Greek world who suggested the Earth was flat. Just as today, I suppose, we have people who are flat earthers who are just very eccentric, but it never caught on, and there was never any doubt in the mind of the official church, in the Catholic Church through the Middle Ages, that the earth was a sphere. No one was ever persecuted for saying otherwise.
Now, if we keep looking at Aristotle, and I don't say any of this to be hard on Aristotle, I tend to be a good Thomist in my philosophy, and we greatly value Aristotle, but he wasn't a scientist. But he held to the position, in fact, that his age was a kind of golden age, I think, and he didn't expect there to be really any scientific advancement. Now, that's correct, isn't it?
Well, it's a difficult thing what the Greeks thought about progress, because Aristotle believed that the Earth was eternal, so he believed that the past went back infinitely.
Yeah.
And the reason that you can't see all the evidence of the past is there'd been a series of cataclysms and floods, which had wiped out all the evidence from time to time. And to some extent, that might give him a rather fatalistic view that mankind could never progress so far before the next great cataclysm and having to start again. Aristotle certainly thought he was developing new knowledge, and he was quite... he was quite proud of the fact that he'd discovered things that other people didn't know. I think the idea that you could progress human good through material advances rather than just intellectual advances is something which probably had been quite alien to his way of thinking. For a start, he very much looked down on people who used their hands for their work. He thought that the only correct thing for a gentleman to be doing was to be sitting around and thinking very hard all day.
Now, when the church rose up and it got the power to start doing things differently, this really changed. What was it about the church that made the difference? What did they believe that Aristotle didn't believe that allowed them to start doing what we would call experimental science?
Well, that's a very very interesting question. I think there were actually really quite a number of different factors, none of which were absolutely determinative on their own, but all of which added up to a completely different view of the world to the one that Aristotle had. For instance, of course, all Christians believe that God created the world. And even though Christians who are in the modern world like me believe that God created the universe billions of years ago, we still totally accept that second line of the creed that God was the creator of heaven and earth. And that means that because we think we know God, we think we must know certain things about his creation. And because God is a law-abiding deity, because he lays down the way that he thinks things should work, we can expect that there are laws about of nature as well, and these laws have been ordained by God for a reason. So we can expect to find that nature makes sense, that nature is rational, and by discovering those laws, we're discovering God's will, and that's actually something that's really worth doing as far as a Christian is concerned. And I think it goes a little bit further than that as well, because Aristotle believed in natural laws. But Aristotle's natural laws were strictly logical. There was no room for any kind of freedom or creativity in nature as far as he was concerned, because nature was ruled by absolutely iron, deterministic laws. Whereas a Christian comes along and he says, well, actually, because the laws of nature were ordained by a free God, we can't actually say they are simply based on logic. They are based on God's will. So it's not possible to work out what they are simply on logical first principles, which is generally what Aristotle tried to do. Instead, we have to go out there and we have to look at the world, we have to test the world and actually understand the real world before we're able to determine what those laws of nature are that God has decided to use in his creation. And that means that you have a very different view about how you have to investigate nature and do science if you're a Christian than if you are a pantheist, I suppose, like Aristotle.
Yeah, I'm going to be getting a little bit ahead of myself, but we'll make sure we backtrack some. But you talked about how they did this thing that they were discovering God's will. In fact, it's my understanding that when people like Kepler and Newton did their science later on, if they started filling in these so-called gaps, they didn't think they were destroying the work of God in the process, such as God of the Gaps terminology. They thought they were, in fact, exemplifying the work of God. And I think Kepler even had on practically every page of his works that this is all done to the glory of God. Is that correct?
Well, absolutely right. And Kepler was a fantastically devout man. Even by the standards of his own time, the 17th century, where many people were, of course, extremely devout. You can read his manuscripts, and he bursts into spontaneous prayer in them while he's actually doing his science. And as far as Kepler was concerned, because the universe was created by God, the universe has to reflect God. It has to work perfectly. And he knew, because he'd done the best observations that anyone had done in history, that the model of the universe, which had been put together by Ptolemy the Greek and Copernicus and Kepler's own teacher, Tycho Brahe, weren't quite perfect. And in particular, he found that the predictions for the orbit of Mars were just very, very slightly out. Now, a more less pernickety man than Kepler might as well, okay, we'll let that pass. We've got a model that works pretty well. We don't really need to be exact. But for Kepler, that was not good enough, because as far as he was concerned, he was trying to discover how it was that God had created the universe, and God didn't make little mistakes like that. So it was obvious to Kepler that the model had to be wrong, that they hadn't discovered the way that God had decided to work, make the universe work. And he kept going and he kept going until he was finally able to come up with the correct hypothesis that planets don't orbit in circles, they orbit in ellipses. And this meant that finally he was able to say, I have got a model of the solar system which is, as far as my very good measurements can tell, absolutely perfect. And that is the reason, in fact, that people finally accepted that the Earth goes around the Sun. It wasn't because of Galileo or Copernicus. It was because Kepler's tables of where the planets were supposed to be were so phenomenally accurate compared to anything else which had gone before, it was abundantly clear that Kepler's model had to be right. And Kepler had reached that kind of accuracy because he was determined that he was going to find the perfect model that God had ordained.
Okay, well, my guest right now is Dr. James Hannum. We're going to be taking a little bit break. When we come back, we'll be discussing further this fascinating topic.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Hi, this is Justin Brierley of the Unbelievable Radio Show and Podcast, recommending another podcast to you. Nick Peters is a deep thinker, a friend of mine, and he has an inspiring faith. So you should listen to him and his excellent guests on the Deeper Waters Show. So keep going deeper and keep getting wetter, I guess. Blessings, Nick. Keep up the good work.
I'd like to thank Justin Brierley for that promo. Someone on your side of the pond, I believe, Dr. Hannum. Dr. Hannum is our guest today discussing science in the Middle Ages. Call-in number is 714-242-5180 for your questions or even maybe your disagreements. Now, going back a little bit, the church has risen up, and now we've entered this period that modern atheism likes to call the Dark Ages, that some people call the Middle Ages, and it was followed by the Enlightenment. But you seem to have a problem with each of these terms to describe the various periods. Could you explain that?
Well, I think the problem with those terms is that they're just completely judgmental. To call a period the Dark Ages is to suggest that everybody was completely ignorant. And I mean, admittedly, the term Dark Ages was first suggested because there were fewer written histories of that period than there were for later periods and earlier periods. In fact, that isn't quite true. We know quite a lot about the so-called Dark Ages now. They're not quite so dark. But quickly the idea caught on that the Dark Ages were called that because they were this period of benighted barbarism which followed the fall of the Roman Empire before the Renaissance, the rebirth of Europe, which of course is what Renaissance means. And that's another judgmental term, because if there was a Renaissance, that suggests that civilization really must have been dead before the rebirth happened. And the Enlightenment, well, that suggests that before that time, people had again been living in darkness. And if you are saying, well, the Enlightenment wasn't quite like that, people tend to assume that you're against Enlightenment, you like people to be benighted. So by using those kinds of terms, you're able to frame the argument in a way that simply makes anyone who's suggesting that the Middle Ages were perhaps rather more important than people imagined, that the Enlightenment was perhaps rather less important than people imagined, seem to be just on the wrong side of history.
Now, when you talk about the beginning of science, Ms. Thomas, it's my understanding that it began in an area most of us wouldn't suspect, and that's agriculture. Is that correct?
Well, it's certainly the case that some of the earliest and most important technological advances in medieval Europe were in the field of agriculture. In particular, certain inventions which may have been made somewhat earlier became very much more popular during the early Middle Ages. For instance, the heavy plough, which enables the heavy but very fertile earth of northern Europe to be turned over and cultivated, became much more popular after the fall of the Roman Empire during the so-called Dark Ages. And water mills, for instance, machinery became much more common than it had been in the Roman world And crop rotation became more advanced during the so-called Dark Ages. So these were actually, this was actually a time when there were really quite important innovations and changes in the way that the countryside was working. And we can see evidence of that because it looks like the population was increasing quite rapidly as we became better and better at producing food, and continued to increase rapidly right up until the Black Death in the 14th century.
Now, this is something that we can often think take for granted. If my wife and I wanted something to eat, for instance, we would probably get in the car, and if we had to, go to a grocery store, pick up something that's already been prepared for us, and come back home. Or heck, we could just stay home, call a pizza delivery place, and have them bring what we want to us. Yet before this was going on in the Middle Ages, and even before that, if you wanted to eat something, you had to go out into your garden, work hard, and plant the seeds and bring them in, or you could go to the marketplace, but even still that required you producing all of your own material. You had to go to the mill and make some bread, or you had to go out and hunt the animal and kill the animal, and that was your food, which would mean you didn't really have a lot of leisure time to do this kind of study. And this development in agriculture did change that, didn't it?
Well, I think the economy during the early Middle Ages is actually rather more advanced than we commonly understand it to be. And we find evidence of trade right the way across Europe. For instance, articles which must have originated in Byzantium have been found in tombs in East Anglia, just north of me here in Kent. And we have evidence of luxury goods being shipped around Europe and through the Mediterranean and up to the British Isles. So I think although the economy was much less advanced, obviously, than it is today, and it became later, and to be fair, less advanced than it was during the Roman Empire, it wasn't as if absolutely everybody was simply having to subsist on their own labour. They were able to go to markets, that there were exchanges of goods, and there was also a money economy in certain places as well.
Mm-hmm. Now, my wife happens to love horses, so I'd be amiss if I didn't mention this, but two of the inventions you talk about at the start of the book that were quite important are actually the horseshoe and the stirrup. Now, how was this so important to the people in the Middle Ages?
Well, the horseshoe is important because it means that a horse, which, of course, was a fantastically valuable and important animal, was able to do far more work than it was able to do previously. But you don't shoe a horse, as everybody who has a horse knows. I don't have one myself, but everyone who has a horse knows that if you don't shoe a horse, then their hooves will rapidly become damaged, and if they are kept in particularly muddy places, and the hooves can start to rot, and it's very, very bad for the horse. And that meant that, for instance, if you wanted to plow a field, it wasn't a good idea to use a horse. People tended to use oxen because the horse would simply suffer too much if it was plodding through mud all day, if it was unshod. So the horseshoe meant that the horse became a much more versatile animal than it had been before. Not only did they last longer because their hooves were being protected, they could also work in fields in a way which had just not been possible for them before. And because a horse is a faster draft animal than an oxen, ploughing, which used to take such a long time, became progressively quicker as people were switching from using oxen to plough to horses. The stirrup was very important. The stirrup originated, as far as we can tell, in the Great Plains of Asia, and came into Europe from the east around about the 7th or 8th centuries. And it was never known to the Romans, for instance. If you look at Roman statues or Roman art, you'll always see that they don't have any stirrups on their horses. And the stirrup was a huge help if you were using a horse as a weapon, if you were a mounted warrior, because it meant that you were much more able to stay on your mount, and you could use the strength of your horse when you were attacking the enemy. For instance, the stirrup meant that you could brace yourself on the back of a horse and use a lance. Without stirrups, if you use a lance, you will just fly straight off the back of a horse because there's almost nothing holding you on. Or they would have to use extremely high saddles, which were seriously limited your maneuverability in the saddle. So the stirrup meant that the horse became a much more effective weapon. And it therefore, for instance, most famously at the Battle of Hastings in England in 1066, the mounted warriors of William the Conqueror were able to defeat the Saxons, even though the Saxons were in a shield wall at the top of quite a steep rise, which should have left them essentially in an invulnerable position. But as soon as that shield wall was broken by the Norman cavalry, the Saxons were cut down by the mounted knights.
Now, she also had suggested I ask about this question. You do talk about Christians making great advancements in science, but to be fair, it wasn't just Christians who were doing this, was it? I do know that there were some Muslims who were making great advancements for a while, but were there also other non-Christians doing study in this time?
Well, Muslim science was certainly important, and the sort of the golden age of the caliphate from the 8th to around about the 11th century, there was important scientific work being done in the Muslim world, not necessarily by Muslims, interestingly enough, but also by Christians and pagans who were living under Muslim rule. But most of the Muslim work was in the quite narrow field of mathematics, something which they were very, very good at, and they also brought the mathematics of India into Europe for the first time. In fact, of course, Arabic numerals, which we still use, are actually originated in India and were simply brought into Europe by the Arabs, which is why we call them Arabic numerals. But generally speaking, I think that the importance of Islamic science can easily be exaggerated, because those things, those problems that we talked about earlier, about the scientific method and how Aristotle's method didn't enable him to really make very much scientific advance, those problems weren't solved in the Muslim world. That the reason for that is quite difficult to understand, but I think it has something to do with the fact that in the Muslim world there was really no central doctrine or theology. Everybody in the Muslim world, all Muslims of course, believe in the Quran, but Muslim theology, apart from that basic foundation, is incredibly varied. It goes from the highly rational to the completely mystical, and everything in between. There was no Muslim church, there was no Muslim pope to tell people what the right and wrong of theology and doctrine is. And that, I think, meant that because they spent so much time debating and arguing amongst themselves, you didn't get the kind of agreement about the basics that you have in the Christian world that meant that you could build on those foundations and start moving forward.
When you start talking about the advancements they made in mathematics, I was immediately thinking that they are the ones who are responsible for our understanding of algebra, which is an Arabic word, and I think they also gave us the number zero, didn't they? The Muslims were responsible for such things as algebra, which is an Arabic word, but they also gave us the number zero, which we didn't really have before.
In mathematics, certainly, there were algebra, as you mentioned, algorithm, and their astronomy was in advance of what the Greeks had achieved as well. They produced much more accurate models of the heavens, which were later used by Copernicus without attribution.
This great learning in the Muslim world, it did eventually die off, but in the Christian world, it never really did die off. In fact, your argument also says that Galileo and Kepler and Copernicus, these people didn't just show up in a vacuum. They stood on the shoulders of the giants who came before them in the medieval period.
Yes, it's certainly true that science in Western Europe really just kept going. It was like began in the 12th century, sometimes called the 12th century Renaissance, and there have been continual advances really since that period. Sometimes things have been a bit slower, sometimes things have been very much quicker, but the story of Western science is a story of continuous development for the last 800-900 years, and it never has stopped. It's still going. And I think that's why the idea of the scientific revolution of the 17th century is such a false one, because that suggests that there was this great change in the way that science was done during that period. But in fact, I think although the 17th century was a very important century for scientific advance, it wasn't the only century. In fact, we could pick on almost any century before or since, going back to the High Middle Ages, for a period where science was enjoying some sort of spectacular advance. There wasn't, I think, something about the scientific revolution which really marked it out as the beginning of the scientific story in the West, as it's often suggested to be.
Now, when we talk about this, we need to keep in mind that this period was indeed, as you say, a period of great learning. And I think there were two inventions that came about in this time that really show that. One I don't think you mentioned in your book, I might have just forgotten it, but one you definitely do. The first one is the university, which was largely championed by the Christians, and the second I'm thinking about the hospital, and especially a movement such as during the Crusades of the Hospitallers, where, heck, when I read about it, they seemed even better than the hospitals that we have today. So, is this accurate?
Well, I wouldn't say that they have better hospitals than we have today. They certainly, the earliest hospitals that I think we have records for are in Christian Byzantium, and the idea seems to have spread to the West around about the time of the Crusades, and there were also hospitals in the Muslim world, and they probably got the idea from the Byzantines as well. The university was a completely new and unique thing in Western Europe during the Middle Ages. The first universities of Oxford and Paris and Bologna were like nothing there had ever been before. And although there had been schools of higher learning in the ancient world, like the School of Alexandria forever, for instance, or the School of Athens, and there were the madrasa in the Muslim world, the universities of Europe were functionally different because they were independent, they ruled themselves, they were self-governing corporations of individuals who were coming together to form something which was greater than themselves. And that meant that they were able to ensure that their members had a degree of intellectual freedom that really wasn't available in any other kind of environment. And also, they were essentially immortal because they were corporations. It didn't matter who the individuals were that made them up. Those individuals could come and go, but the university would just keep on going. It could essentially last forever. And, of course, the oldest universities are now coming up to their 800 or 900th birthday, so they are still very much going strong. And I think the university provided a place where science could find a home, could find a reasonably safe home, and it provided a livelihood for people who wanted to study science. It's interesting that the Catholic Church, when it laid down what it thought the syllabus for people who wanted to study theology should be, they said that before you can do theology, you have to have a basic grounding in maths, astronomy, natural philosophy, other kinds of philosophy, and that meant that everybody who was going through the universities was getting a basic education in science, and that had really never happened before.
And that's certainly going to be a shock, I'm sure, to any of my listeners who are atheists. And we'll be asking more about this when we return from our break. I'm Nick Peters. You're listening to the Deeper Waters Podcast. Our guest is Dr. James Hannum.
This is Mike Lacona. Nick Peters is my son-in-law, and I'm excited to announce his new podcast in which Nick will discuss and have guests on topics related to Christian apologetics and dealing with disabilities. Nick has already interviewed apologetic stars such as Greg Kokel and Rob Bowman, and I know of other stars he's in the process of inviting. So be sure to check out Nick's new podcast.
Are you tired of the same old corporate Christian music on the radio? Check out Music Surge on Grok Radio, playing Christian music that doesn't suck. Download episodes now at cyiworldwide.com.
We're back. I'm Nick Peters of the Deeper Waters Podcast. Our guest is Dr. James Hannum, author of the book God's Philosophers, also known as The Genesis of Science. We're talking about science in the medieval period. Our call-in number is 714-242-5180. Our lines are open. Now, we just start talking about the universities. Now, this might surprise a number of listeners because there's this idea that Christians believe things based on faith and everyone else believes things based on reason, or at least Christians believe Christianity on faith. They could believe other things on reason, but when it comes to Christianity, it's faith. And I'd contend that this dichotomy we have, a split between faith and reason, is more of a modern idea. It really wouldn't fit well in the medieval period, would it?
Well, no, not at all. I mean, Edward Grant, the very esteemed historian of medieval science, says that the Middle Ages were actually an age of reason.
Mm-hmm.
As far as medieval scholars were concerned, there was a place for faith, but reason was something which was also a gift from God. Our rationality was part of our nature that we had received from the divine, and so reason was something which we should be using. It's something that we can rely on if we use it correctly. And in particular, although that they believed, and I think they're right about this, you cannot rationally prove absolutely everything about Christianity, they did believe that if you came across something which was heretical, you could always use reason to refute that heresy. And that meant that reason was a tremendously important tool as far as they were concerned.
Now, from what I've gathered in my own studies, is that when they held something to be seen as a faith belief, it meant that it was held largely based on special revelation, that reason could help you understand it, but reason alone couldn't demonstrate it. For instance, Christians believe in the Trinity, but if all you have is just your reason, you're not going to be able to get to the Trinity. But when you have special revelation that says there is a Trinity, you can believe that based on the authority of God, but you can still use reason in application of that belief. Would that be accurate?
I think that's true, and you would further, I think, be able to say that you could use your reason as a tool to refute alternatives to the Trinity. The reason was a tool which could be used against Unitarians and other kinds of anti-Trinitarian.
Mm-hmm. And in fact, thinkers like Aquinas, for instance, had a huge problem with this idea known as the double theory of truth. You know, they said something could be true in the area of reason, and the contradictory could be true in the area of faith. And that would not have been a very popular position to many philosophers in the Middle Ages. It would have been seen as a contradictory. If they had something in the Trinity that did contradict reason, they'd have a problem.
Well, of course, when the Bishop of Paris, Stephen Tempierre, in 1277, issued his condemnations against certain philosophers who had been taking an arch-rationalistic approach, he specifically condemned this idea of the double truth, that things could be, as you say, correct rationally and wrong in faith. He said there is absolutely no way that faith and reason can ever contradict each other. Reason may not be enough on its own, but it could never contradict what faith said.
Now, we talked about how this was seen as heresy in many times with some of these beliefs and how they dealt with heretical beliefs. You spend some time talking about ideas like the Inquisition in your book, and there is a lot of misinformation about that. Could you tell us briefly what the Inquisition really was about?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to suggest for a moment that the Inquisition was a very nice thing. I don't defend for a moment the idea that we should be persecuting heretics rather than simply arguing with them. But in the Middle Ages, because society believed that it was essential to keep on the right side of God or bad things would happen, it was a matter of policy that heresy had to be dealt with severely. But the church realized that you simply couldn't leave that sort of thing to ordinary people, to secular justice, because it was simply too harsh. What the church wanted to do with a heretic was to convince them they were wrong and welcome them back into the arms of the faith. And that was really what started the Inquisition off. The Inquisition was intended as a way of finding heretics and of correcting heretics, but only if those heretics were refusing to recant of their mistakes would they be handed over to the secular arm, where, of course, rather disgustingly, they would have been burnt at the stake. Mm-hmm. What's very important about the way that the Inquisition operated was that it used a form of evidence-based justice which simply really hadn't existed before it came into being. Secular justice in those days tended to be based on character witnesses. So if you had a bad name, you could almost never defend yourself against a crime, whether you were innocent or not. Although, of course, there were trials by ordeal, which the church tried to ban, but they kept going. So instead, the popes in the Middle Ages developed the justice system known as Inquisition, where a magistrate would investigate all the evidence, interview all the witnesses, and then, and only then, would he be able to come to a conclusion on whether somebody had actually been a heretic based on what he'd heard. And that was a huge step forward in terms of justice, as well as, of course, a much better way of actually establishing what was really going on. And the influence of the Inquisition system of justice was so great that even today, the criminal justice system all the way across Western Europe, except, in fact, in the British Isles, is still based on the medieval Inquisition method of having a magistrate who investigates cases of alleged criminality. And, in fact, as far as people in continental Europe are concerned, they think it works a lot better than the system we have in the more adversarial system that we have in the US and in the United Kingdom.
Now, you and I already agree that one heretic being burned at the stake or tortured or whatever is too many. But there is a whole lot of exaggeration on atheists' side about what happened in the Inquisition. For instance, there was no record that millions were put to death by the Inquisition.
Well, one thing you can say for the Inquisition is they did keep very good records. So now historians have actually dug down and looked at the records that we've got. So we've got some fairly solid figures about the number of people who were imprisoned and who were executed by the Inquisition. For instance, we now know that the Spanish Inquisition, that really very notorious institution, ended up executing something like 2% of cases, and they were only people who refused to recant or who were second offenders. Everybody was given a second chance by the Inquisition. And we also know that the Inquisitors very rarely used torture. You find very, very few descriptions of torture being used by church inquisitors. It was, however, much more likely to be used by secular authorities. Now, it is true that if you top them all up, you will find that the Spanish Inquisition did end up killing thousands of people, and that's a really dreadful thing. But it was in existence for something like 400 years. And it's something I find very ironic that the fiercely anti-Catholic and anti-Christian Jacobins of the French Revolution, their revolutionary terror managed to kill more people in 3 years than the Inquisition had managed throughout its entire 800 years of existence, if we include mm-hmm. the medieval Inquisition as well as the Spanish Inquisition.
Now, since we're talking about science, let's get some numbers here as well. How many people were put to death by the Inquisition for their scientific beliefs?
Well, none, as far as we can tell. Mm-hmm. We do not have records of anybody being executed for beliefs that we would understand as scientific. There
now,
is a record of an astrologer being executed during the Middle Ages, a chap called Secco d'Ascoli, and he was executed after he had been initially convicted. He was given a penance and he was told to reform his ways. He fled to another city. He set up his astrology again, and one of the things that he was saying was that Jesus' life was determined by the stars that he was born under, and the reason that Jesus was poor and was crucified was because he was badly affected by the heavens. In other words, he was saying that Jesus or God himself was affected by astrology, and obviously that was a very, very serious thing to be saying. And it's remarkable that even that really very serious heresy wasn't dealt with particularly severely the first time that Secco d'Ascoli was caught. It was only the second time that he was executed. And in 1600, Giordano Bruno was burnt in Rome. And Bruno is often held up as a martyr for science. But in fact, although he did support Copernicus in believing that the Earth goes around the Sun, if you study his writings, you don't find very much there that seems scientific at all. He was, in fact, something of a New Age pagan, a mystic. And his mission seemed to be to try and convert the Pope to his new pagan religion rather than to promote science of any sort. And we do have the list of things that he was suspected of while he was on trial, although, unfortunately, the trial records themselves were lost during the Napoleonic Wars. And there's nothing in there about the Earth going around the Sun or anything else that is particularly scientific, except for his saying that the universe was infinite. But then that wasn't something which he believed for scientific reasons either.
We'll be saving also the case of Galileo for our fifth segment of the show. I'd like to be able to have this one segment to totally focus on him. So for law skeptics listening, that one is coming up indeed. But really, the church did allow a lot of scientific leeway. They didn't hold to what we would often refer to as a literalist interpretation of scripture, did they?
Well, not necessarily, no. Mm-hmm. People tended to read scripture before the Protestant Reformation on many different levels. And they would read it as symbolic, they could read it as metaphorical, they could read it as being literally true, depending on what the context was.
Yes.
For instance, there was a medieval theologian called William of Conches who says that if you were to read the book of Genesis completely literally, it's completely absurd, which does sound really quite a modern viewpoint, but of course it wasn't a modern viewpoint. It was a viewpoint that people in the Middle Ages were really quite comfortable with.
Mm-hmm.
You would read in Genesis, you would get the impression that the moon was a light in its own right, because that seems to be what the literal words say. But even the Pope himself was perfectly aware that the moon was only reflecting the light of the sun, that it wasn't a light in its own right.
Mm-hmm. Now, when we're talking about this kind of thing also, Augustine even, back at the start of the medieval period, he wrote a book called The Literal Meaning of Genesis. And in it, he argued that Genesis, the account, was an instantaneous creation, and yet this was considered literal.
Well, when Augustine was talking about the literal meaning of Genesis, he didn't, I think, mean the word literal in quite the way that we would mean it. I think
yeah.
he meant the the written meaning of Genesis, the actual meaning of Genesis, perhaps. But yes, I mean, that's a very interesting text, because in that text, Augustine gets quite cross with some of his fellow Christians for talking complete nonsense about science and making the Christianity look a bit silly. He feels that it's quite wrong for Christians to start talking about scientific matters on the basis of what they know from Scripture, as if they're authorities on the subject, because it simply gives Christianity a bad name. But what he did say, as you mentioned, he does say some very interesting things about how the universe might have been created, and that it may have been created in an instant, and in particular that time appears to have been created at the same time as the material universe is. So time itself is part of creation, and that's something which has been confirmed to a very great extent by modern cosmology and Big Bang theory.
Yeah. I was listening to a thing that this was a prediction made back in the 4th and 5th century, and it only wasn't until the 20th century that we found something that I think could be said as scientific evidence for this belief.
Well, it's interesting that 100 years ago, and I quoted a passage from a book from 100 years ago, the general belief was among non-believing scientists was that the universe had to be eternal, that it couldn't possibly have had a beginning. So it was really quite a shock to the system, as far as atheist science was concerned, when the Big Bang was first proposed and the evidence for it mounted and mounted and mounted. And of course, the very famous atheist physicist at Cambridge, Fred Hoyle, came up with his alternative steady state theory for creation, and he did so, he said explicitly, because he didn't like the idea of the Big Bang meaning that the universe had a beginning, because he just thought that's impossible.
Now, also, the one who first came up with the Big Bang theory was, in fact, a devout Catholic priest. And when he presented it to the Pope was immediately ready to use this as a proof for God's existence. And the priest himself said, no, don't do this, because he was very concerned about tying in the existence of God with a scientific principle. What do you think about that?
Well, I think that's really quite a sensible point. The Belgian Catholic priest, and whose name I have to admit I've just forgotten, who first suggested the Big Bang, he didn't feel that science was something that was equipped to prove theological truths. He thought that science, and he's right about this, I think, was simply the study of the natural world. And although the natural world is God's creation, theology goes higher than that and goes further than that. And science is simply not the right subject to be doing if you want to discover about God.
You know, this is quite a contrast, isn't it, to a lot of our modern-day atheists. For instance, Victor Stinger has the book God, the Failed Hypothesis, which says if we treat the question of God scientifically, we find that it fails. And people like myself look at that and say, this is a total category fallacy. And it's quite a shock to our modern scientism thinking that says science is the highest way of knowing the truth, when really this quite likely isn't the way.
Well, I think Victor Senger, in common with some of the other so-called new atheists, suffer from something of a lack of vision. They simply don't seem to be able to imagine that there's anything in the world, or anything even outside the world, that might possibly not be susceptible to their very reductionist way of looking at things. And therefore, they think to themselves, well, if I can't see something using my scientific spectacles, it doesn't exist. And there was a British philosopher before the war, Herbert Butterfield, I think, very possibly, I forget his name, and he suggested that this was a bit like if you were a fisherman and you were fishing in a pond, and you found that there were no fish at all in your net, you conclude that there are no fish in the pond. But in fact, what's been happening is the fish are just too small and they are swimming through your net. and because the equipment you've been using has been the wrong equipment to actually find the fish, you would be wrong in your assumption that the fish don't exist. And it's the same by using science to try and do theology. Science is a wrong tool, so it's simply not surprising that you come up with no useful results.
I find that to be a very good analogy. Well, when we come back, I'd like to spend the next segment talking about medicine in the medieval period. But my guest is Dr. James Hannon. We'll be back after this break.
Nick.
Join Unituber and Army Girl for Christ as they discuss spiritual warfare, spiritual preparedness, the end times, life issues, and personal and spiritual growth. At www.truthradionet.com. Truthradionet.com.
Hey, this is Minister Grock. Thanks for listening. Although Grock Radio is free, there are costs to upkeep the website, podcast, and purchase Bibles and materials for street ministry. And while we are happy to pay this ourselves out of pocket, we will gladly accept any gift if you feel led to support the shows and our street ministry. You can send a gift or love offering through our website at cyiworldwide.com. Thanks for your support, and God bless.
And I would like to remind everyone that we are listener-supported, and we definitely do appreciate your prayer for and financial support. Now, I think we lost you for a while, Dr. Hannon, but you're back, and I think for that break you were getting ready to say something.
Sorry about that. I think I got cut off.
I don't know what happened. If it was my endurance, I don't know, but I apologize for any mishap. Anything that happened certainly wasn't intentional. I think you were getting ready to say something to me, though.
No, it's all right. I think you said we were going to talk about medicine in the next section.
Yeah, I thought that'd be a very fascinating topic. You've said in your book, for instance, if you were sick, you could be better off going to the church than you could to a doctor. Is that correct?
Well, I think that was true, really, until the middle of the 19th century.
Mm-hmm.
Because it wasn't until around about 1850 that medicine actually, on balance, would do you any good at all. It wasn't until then that doctors stopped killing their patients and started being able to cure some of them.
Mm-hmm.
And I find it absolutely incredible that the medical profession had managed to maintain its prestige right the way up until that point, even though, in fact, it really was doing no good at all. The only thing a competent doctor could do was to tell you reasonably accurately what disease you had and what might happen, but he couldn't cure it. And many of the treatments which a doctor would suggest during the Middle Ages, during the ancient Greek period, right up until the 19th century, things like purging and bleeding, they were going to make you more ill, not help you get better. They would weaken you so that you're more likely to die of your disease than if you had simply not gone to the doctor at all. So if the only thing you do when you're ill is go to a shrine, go to a church, pray to God, even if God isn't listening, you're probably going to be better off than if you go to a doctor.
Mm-hmm. And a lot of this was in fact based on pagan science. For instance, Galen, back in the 2nd and 3rd century, who had this idea of a balance of the humors of the body, and that was still held to for a long time, wasn't it?
It was, absolutely. Galen was a textbook for doctors, again, right up until the 19th century. In fact, the standard edition of Galen, even now, which was came out, well, over 100 years ago now, that standard edition was actually put together not for historians or people who wanted to study ancient Greek medicine. That edition was put together for doctors because it was thought they would want to consult Galen in a simple, convenient, multi-volume set rather than having to search around for all the different texts. And the prestige that Galen had as the founder of medicine was absolutely enormous. It wasn't until, for instance, the 16th century that Andreas Vesalius was able to start carrying out human dissections, which were able to show that Galen had been wrong about quite a number of things. In fact, of course, Galen wasn't able to dissect human beings because that was strictly against the law in ancient Rome where he was living. He had to dissect apes and pigs instead. So what he had to say about the workings of the human body were actually based on what he saw in other animals, so it's no surprise that he made really quite a lot of mistakes. And although human dissection was allowed in medieval Europe, surprisingly enough, the Christian church didn't object to human dissection in a way that almost every other society had done. It did take really quite a long time and really quite a few people actually having done human dissection before it was realized that Galen had been wrong.
Now, why was it that the Roman society, and for that record every other society, back to Curly, did condemn human dissection?
Well, they just thought that it was blasphemous, that it was wrong, and it was unclean. There were different reasons in different societies. For instance, you read in the Greek historian Herodotus that after a battle, the Persians would pick over the bodies because they were barbarians and they behaved like that. Whereas the ancient Greeks, who were civilized people, they wouldn't do that. They wouldn't touch the dead bodies because they were unclean, and that was a disgusting thing to do. Mm-hmm. And in ancient Egypt, although you had the practice of embalming and mummies, that didn't in fact seem to extend as far as actually doing research on dead bodies. There's a rather unpleasant story, actually, that in Alexandria in around about the 3rd century BC, a couple of ancient Greek medical researchers were allowed by the pharaoh to take prisoners from the local prison and actually do vivisections on them, to do experiments on them while they were still alive. And the discoveries that they made while doing that meant that their work on anatomy continued to be extremely valuable for years and years afterwards, although, of course, obviously you wouldn't want to say that what they were doing was okay as a result of that. But it was interesting that vivisection was briefly acceptable in the ancient Greek world, but dissection of dead bodies never was.
But interestingly now, you said that the Christian world did allow human dissection of dead bodies, of course. They wouldn't have allowed you to cut open living bodies, I don't think, but they did allow you to look at dead bodies, which is contrary to what so many people think. Why was it the church didn't have a problem with it?
Well, I think part of the reason was that the first dissections were actually legal autopsies. They were attempts to find cause of death. So they weren't medical, although they weren't for research. They were for legal purposes. But once that taboo had been broken, then the church sort of thought, well, if we're going to let it happen for legal purposes, then it seems sensible that we let doctors dissect bodies as part of their training, because it might help them be better doctors. It didn't actually, but, you know, it was a nice thought. And perhaps part of the reason is that Christians had, at least in the Middle Ages, they had an idea that the spirit and our spirits and our bodies were somehow separate things, and that therefore once a body was dead, the spirit had departed, and what you did with the body really didn't matter very much.
And so it gets us to this interesting little contradiction to what most of us hear today, which I started with at the start of the show, that the Greeks and the Romans were advancing science when Christianity came along and messed everything up. When in fact it would seem that it was the Roman belief that was impeding science and the Christian belief that was allowing for the advancement of it.
Well, certainly, yes. The first time in history that we see dissection of human beings for research and medical purposes is in the Christian Middle Ages, and that, I think, is quite a remarkable thing. And so in the 16th century, you have the work of Andreas Vesalius, his fantastic illustrations in his book on the human body, which were produced by the studio of Titian in Venice, opening up the human body to the view of really anybody who wanted to have a look at this book. And the reason Vesalius was doing what he was doing was, as far as he was concerned, the human was the very pinnacle of God's creation. And by showing what a fantastic piece of machinery the human body was, he was praising God as well.
Mm-hmm. And this would also include someone you mentioned in your book, William Harvey.
Yes, that's right, who was an English doctor who discovered the circulation of the blood.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, Galen had believed that blood didn't circulate, it was created and just destroyed in a constant cycle. And Harvey realized that there was just too much blood. It was impossible that the body was creating and destroying all the blood that was supposedly flowing through, because it would have had to create vast amounts of it. So he realized that the blood had to be circulating, even though, in fact, it wasn't possible to see the tiny capillaries through which the blood was passing when it reached the organs of the body. So he realized that the heart was a pump. And again, he was someone who very much thought of the human body as a machine designed by God, and discovering how it worked was a religious duty, if you like.
Now, this kind of gets us to something else as well. I think one of the great mistakes of modern science is they've gotten rid of what Aristotle called final causality, which is why something does what it does, the purpose of it. And I think even the modern intelligent design movement doesn't look enough at final causality. It just looks at how we get there. And yet for Aristotle, final causality, the final cause was the most important cause. And it looks like the final cause was also quite important to the medieval Christians, wasn't it?
Well, it was, because for medieval Christians, really everything had to have a purpose. And they didn't tend to look at the way that the world was worked as being something which was just formed by impersonal forces. They believed that the world was the way it was because God had made it that way, and God had made it that way for a reason. And by discovering that reason, then you discover something that God wanted you to know. And it's particularly the case with different kinds of animals and bestiaries, for instance, which were books of all sorts of fantastic animals, some of which existed and some of which didn't, were religious rather than scientific books. They were books where the way that the particular animal behaved or looked was some kind of educational tool. For instance, it was said that the phoenix was destroyed by fire and then rose again after 3 days, and so it prefigured Jesus in some sort of way. There were birds which were said to eat their young, and then their young would come out of them again after 3 days, and that was again prefiguring the way that Jesus was resurrected from the tomb.
In fact,
that doesn't sound very scientific to us, but it suggests that for the medieval mind, the world was much more full of meaning, perhaps, than it is today.
In fact, when we talk about discussing these kinds of things, in your book you bring up the example of Adelard, who wrote a book discussing with his nephew, I think, about scientific questions and such, and he was entirely open to all the questions. And I do like what you say here. Adelard's science was wrong, often spectacularly so, but not because he was irrational or superstitious. When people did science wrong back then, it wasn't because they believed in God and they had superstitious and crazy ideas. It was because they just didn't have the kind of knowledge that we have today.
Yes, and I think we have to be very careful not to be condescending towards people in the past mm-hmm. who just aren't in a position to know what we know. We want to know something, we can just Google it, and there it is. Whereas if you wanted to discover something before the advent of printing, you would have found it extremely difficult even to find a relevant book. So Abelard, as you say, was really writing from a position of ignorance. I mean, that is best. He comes up with some quite ingenious ideas, but the poor chap really doesn't stand a chance. Some of the questions which his nephew is asking are really quite difficult, such as, do stars eat? Which is the sort of thing that my five-year-old might ask me, and I would find a bit of a challenge as well.
Mm-hmm. In fact, one thing we have to be careful of in our modern era is we can too easily look back on these people and say, well, we know today if this is true, why didn't they? And this is even going to be in what's going to be discussed in our next segment on Galileo, that even if we know something is true today, it was still true back then, but they didn't have the means to demonstrate that it was true back then, or the arguments to demonstrate that it was true. In fact, usually the most rational arguments would go the other way.
Well, yes, and then, of course, with Galileo saying that the Earth is moving and the Earth is rotating, and that's a pretty strange idea when you think about it, because when we look at the world, everything appears to be stationary. We don't get swept off our feet as it spins around. We don't find this rushing wind as it sweeps through the universe. It really does seem to be very solid and standing still. And there were very good, solid reasons of physics for believing that the Earth is stationary. Somebody to come along and say, well, actually, the Earth is rotating at 1,000 miles an hour, which is roughly what it needs to be doing, and is traveling through space at tens of thousands of miles an hour, I think that's a crazy idea.
In fact, with your background in physics, you probably answer it differently. I mean, I hold, of course, that the Earth goes around the sun, but if someone came up to me and said, demonstrate this, I'd be at a loss to demonstrate how to do it. It's just accepted on good authority that this is what we all know. And so it kind of does put us in a hard spot if we're going to mock people in the medieval period for something that most of us couldn't even demonstrate today.
Well, exactly. It is a very difficult... I mean, it's difficult enough to show that the Earth is rotating. We can use Foucault's pendulum to do that, but it's a bit of a complicated explanation. But it shows that the Earth is actually moving through space. It's something you can only really do by observing the planets for hundreds and hundreds of hours, and then postulating a hypothesis that explains what's going on and show that the Earth must therefore be in motion. It's not something you can demonstrate directly.
Mm-hmm. And before we get to Galileo, of course, there were people who came before him, like Copernicus and Kepler and Bray, and from what I gather from your book, none of these people thought they were going against Christianity. They were, in fact, good churchmen.
Yes, absolutely. I know Copernicus was a canon of the cathedral. Kepler, we've already discussed, was an incredibly devout man. And Galileo wasn't massively religious, but, I mean, he was a conventional Catholic of his time, and there's no particular evidence that he was in rebellion against the church. He believed that the church had been wrong to say that Copernicus was mistaken about the Earth moving, and he believed that the church should correct what it had said. But that was really because he wanted the church to be right, not because he was trying to attack the church.
And Copernicus, when he wrote his book explaining his theory that the Earth goes around the sun, he even dedicated it to the Pope, didn't he? And the Pope accepted it.
Yes, that's right. Although whether or not he read it, I don't know. And it was, in fact, Copernicus's book on astronomy wasn't the first book of astronomy to be dedicated to this particular Pope. But there was certainly a cardinal who was quite high up in the church in Rome who was much, much more interested in the work that Copernicus was doing and personally urged him to publish.
Anyway, when we come back, we'll be talking about Galileo a bit more. I'm Nick Peters. This is the Deeper Waters Podcast. We'll be back after this break.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com. Home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
Hi, this is Justin Brierley of the Unbelievable Radio Show and Podcast, recommending another podcast to you. Nick Peters is a deep thinker, a friend of mine, and he has an inspiring faith. So you should listen to him and his excellent guests on the Deeper Waters show. So keep going deeper and keep getting wetter, I guess. Blessings, Nick. Keep up the good work.
And we're back. Our guest is Dr. James Hannum, talking about science and medieval period. The number is 714-242-5180. Now, chapter 19 of your book begins this way. I'd like to read part of this first paragraph. According to the traditional history of science, Galileo was a man of unparalleled originality. He was, supposedly, the first person to show that objects of different weights fall at the same speed, the first to claim that vacuums could really exist, and the first to realize projectiles moving curves. He rejected Aristotle when everyone else followed him slavishly. It is said that he proved Copernicus was right and that the Inquisition cast him into prison as a result. As it turns out, none of these things is exactly true. Would you care to explain that?
Well, I think that there's quite a lot of things about what people generally believe about Galileo which aren't true.
Mm-hmm.
If we begin with the physics that you mentioned, that he's believed to have discovered that heavy and light objects, for instance, fall at the same speed. And that was something that wasn't realized by the ancient Greeks. So Aristotle said that heavy objects had to fall faster than light ones. So did almost all the ancient Greeks that followed him. We find this being said for centuries afterwards. And that's incredible, because it doesn't take more than 10 seconds to prove that it's wrong. You simply have to drop a tablespoon and a teaspoon, and you'll find that they both hit the ground at the same time. And remarkably, it wasn't until the 6th century AD when we first find a philosopher saying, well, actually, this is wrong. Heavy objects and light objects do seem to fall at about the same speed. And remarkably, the philosopher who said that in Alexandria, someone called John Philoponus, was in fact one of the very first Christian Greek philosophers. And he took a fairly radical view of Aristotle's science for his time. Although, unfortunately, because of the Islamic invasion of Egypt, the Alexandrian school was snuffed out shortly afterwards. But Galileo wasn't the first person to say that heavy and light objects fall at the same pace. And he also was using a considerable amount of medieval science in his important books. For instance, the mean speed theorem, which had been developed in 14th century Oxford, was something which, if you read Galileo, you really would think he says he was inventing himself. But he wasn't. He was 200 years old when he picked it up. And he wasn't even the first person to say that, to describe the way that an object falls under gravity, although that's something else that he very much implies he discovered himself. But we know of a Spanish natural philosopher from several decades beforehand who had said the same thing. So his science, although very, very important, wasn't really quite as original as he makes out. And as for his clash with the Inquisition, I think that's something which is very much misunderstood by many, many people today. It is true and very unfortunate that the Catholic Church, in around about 1605, I think, banned the view that the church that the earth is moving around the sun. They put it to some committee of theologians, and theologians said that it was wrong. Galileo himself was one of the few people who actually believed that the earth moves at the time. Very few other natural philosophers did believe it. The church was simply reiterating what was the scientific orthodoxy of the time. Galileo, although they thought he was wrong, was told that he hadn't done anything wrong himself, and he didn't have to worry about getting into any trouble with the Inquisition. But he was warned that he shouldn't go around and continuing to support the idea that Copernicus was right. But then Unfortunately for him, he rather overstepped the bounds which had been set for him. When a close friend of his became Pope Urban VIII, he explained to the Pope why he thought that it was ridiculous that the Church had banned heliocentrism. And the Pope seemed to be quite sympathetic about this, and gave Galileo the impression that he kind of had permission to fill out the ban. And so Galileo went off and wrote a book which was supposed to be an impartial comparison between the system that the ancient Greeks had believed, that the Earth is the stationary center of the universe, and the system that Copernicus suggested, that the Earth goes around the Sun, which is the center of the universe. But in fact, the book was a straightforward argument in favor of Copernicus against the ancient Greek Ptolemy. But worst of all, unfortunately, at the end of it, Galileo puts an argument into the mouth of the person who represents the old and unfashionable view, who he's really been making a fool of throughout the book. He puts an argument into the mouth of this person, which is exactly an argument that the Pope himself had suggested to Galileo. And because everybody thought that the Pope had given Galileo permission to write this book, it was even published. It was passed by the official censor of the Catholic Church and was printed and distributed, and the Pope got his copy, and he was absolutely incandescent with fury because he thought that Galileo had abused his trust and was insulting him. And so he instantly ordered that the book be suppressed and banned, and all the copies gathered up and pulped or burned. And this was really quite embarrassing as far as the Church was concerned, because the Church had already given permission for this book to be published, and now it was changing its mind.
Mm-hmm.
So, Galileo was really extraordinarily unpopular with the Church, and especially with the Pope, and the Pope insisted that Galileo was put on trial and accused of heresy and made to recant everything he'd said about the Earth going around the Sun. And this wasn't so much because saying that the Earth goes around the Sun was this wholly outrageous thing. It was that Galileo had made the Pope feel like he was a fool. He had abused the Pope's trust as far as the Pope was concerned. And so the Pope just thought he had to throw the book at him, or he was going to lose a huge amount of prestige. And this was a disaster as far as the Church has been concerned, a public relations disaster. It's been really one of the most terrible mistakes that the Catholic Church has ever made. But we shouldn't see it as a mistake of science. It was a mistake of personalities. It was a mistake of politics, rather than the Church coming down against science.
If anything, when I've looked at this little squabber, if it was that small word to use to describe it, what's really going on, it seems to me, is that there was a clash of two egos going on, because there really can't be much question that Galileo had a huge ego, and unfortunately the Pope that he argued against had an ego as well, and both of them, neither one was willing to give an inch to the other one.
I think that's true. It was a clash of egos. It was a clash of personalities.
Mm-hmm.
And Galileo bit off more than he could chew. He was an influential and a well-known man, but there was no way he could take on a Pope and win.
Mm-hmm. In fact, I'm reading David Bentley Hart's book right now, and he points out that it's very interesting in this that the Church was the group that was saying, no, let's wait and let's see where the evidence leads. And Galileo was the one wanting to be dogmatic immediately and say, no, let's accept this theory right now, even though the evidence isn't in entirely.
I think David probably goes a little bit too far with that, because what the Church had said wasn't so much that we'll see where the evidence leads. What the Church said was, if the evidence proves that we're wrong, we'll accept it.
Mm-hmm.
But we won't, as of now, we've reached our position, and kind of that's where we're at. if we're proven to be incorrect, then we'll change our minds. But we don't think that's going to happen.
Yeah. And as we said in the last segment, there really wasn't enough evidence to prove that they were incorrect at the time. In fact, if I'm remembering correctly, it wasn't the problem of Obler's paradox, which was, why is the sky dark at night, that wasn't answered until even the 19th century.
That is true. I mean, there are many questions about Copernicanism which simply didn't have answers for ages and ages. And I mean, for instance, if the Earth is moving through space, we should be able to see the stars moving relative in their positions to us, called stellar parallax. But because the stars are so far away, the way that they move is so tiny, it wasn't observed until well into the 18th century, so really a century and a half after Galileo. And the lack of stellar parallax was a really good argument against the Earth being able to move.
And also, part of what Galileo did wrong, according to my understanding, is that he was a trained scientist, but he wasn't a theologian. And unfortunately, he was speaking out on matters of theology, and the church was getting after him, saying, unless you studied theology, you don't need to be talking about theology. And yet he persisted in talking about theology.
I think that's true. Galileo's theology was actually not bad, but as far as the church was concerned, he was an amateur. And there were rules about being an amateur theologian, in the same way that we've got rules today saying you're not allowed to be an amateur lawyer. You can't pretend you're a lawyer just because you've read a few law books. You've got to be properly qualified to do the job. And theology was considered in Galileo's day to be really, really important, and only people who were properly trained were allowed to do it.
In fact, when you said the church's theologians examined the work of Galileo, it wasn't then a group of people that was ignorant of science, since in that day, to be a theologian, you had to have some knowledge of science. The theologians on the court who were examining Galileo's work wouldn't know how to talk about the science involved with it, wouldn't they?
Well, absolutely. And of course, at the time of Galileo, most scientists believed that the Earth is stationary. Galileo's position was very much a minority position, and the church, although it was wrong, was simply siding with the experts.
And in fact, it was around this time, I think, that the Jesuits were being established, and they were bringing their learning with them. In fact, when they went to China and did their missionary work, they also brought along with them their astronomical theories as well.
I'm sorry, I didn't catch that, Nick.
Okay. It was around this time also that the Jesuits were being established, who were certainly people who valued good scholarly learning, and that included astronomy. And even when they went to China, they took their astronomy with them and spread their scientific discoveries too.
They did, yes. And the story of the Jesuits in China, I think, is an absolutely remarkable one. They used their scientific knowledge to gain access to the emperor. I mean, what they wanted to talk to the emperor about was Christianity, but they used their superior science in order to convince the emperor that they had to he had to take them seriously. And there was a contest to organize in Peking between the court astrologers of the emperor and the Jesuits, in order to predict the length and time of an eclipse. And although the Chinese astronomers could get the day right, they couldn't really get more accurate than that, whereas the Jesuit astronomers, using the latest European materials, were able to say exactly when the eclipse was going to be and exactly how long it was going to be. And that was so impressive as far as the emperor was concerned that he promptly let the Jesuits take over the official imperial astronomy.
Yeah. In fact, the Vatican, back in the time of Galileo, they already had their own planetarium, didn't they, where they were doing astronomical studies. And even to this day, the Vatican has its court astronomers and such. In fact, if anyone listens to the Unbelievable podcast, just a couple of weeks ago, Justin Brierley interviewed their main astronomer. So the church has always had an active interest in astronomy.
Well, absolutely. And the church, for instance, it's always been very concerned about the calendar because it has to know when the great feasts are supposed to occur. And getting the calendar right has been a concern of the church for centuries and centuries, and particularly around about the time of Galileo, when, of course, the Gregorian calendar was brought in. And the church has continued to finance astronomy and to patronize astronomy. There is, as you've just mentioned, there's the Vatican Observatory, which is still going after centuries and centuries. And I think, generally speaking, the church, the Catholic Church, has been very friendly towards science. The Jesuits have produced many, many very fine scientists. There have been many other excellent works of science by very devout Catholics through history. And the church has been extremely supportive of that in general, both financially and philosophically. And I think it's very unfair that this single, admittedly very serious mistake that the church made over Galileo should be allowed to completely overshadow everything else that the church has done for science over the last several centuries.
Now, we're often told that Galileo was sent to prison for what he did and stayed there the rest of his life, suffering greatly. But in reality, what did happen to Galileo after his trial?
Well, he was sentenced to house arrest for the rest of his life, which was a comfortable existence because he did have a very nice house back in Florence. He was deprived of his liberty, but he did continue to live very comfortably, and he was able to continue his scientific work. And it's actually quite remarkable that the most important scientific book that Galileo wrote, the Dialogue on Two New Sciences, was actually written while he was under house arrest, rather than when he had had his freedom before his trial. So he ended up doing some of his most important work after the church had condemned him.
What can we learn overall from the whole Galileo affair that's relevant to us today?
Well, I think the important thing about Galileo is to realize that science is not an impersonal venture. Scientists are human beings. They have agendas, they have ambitions. There are things they want to achieve, there are things they don't want to achieve, they've got biases. And all scientists are like that simply because they are like the rest of us people. And we're not robots. And so when you read about what scientists are doing, what the latest theories are, you have to remember that this continues to be a human activity, an activity where there are all sorts of different agendas and biases at work, where people are making mistakes. The strength of science is that it's good at correcting its mistakes. It sometimes takes a very long time, but eventually science seems to be able to correct its mistakes because people try to repeat things that people say that they've done and they find they can't do it. It's a powerful way of proceeding. But it does mean that we need to be quite skeptical about what scientists are telling us. And just because a scientist says something, it doesn't mean that it has more authority simply because it's being dressed up in scientific language. When a scientist says something about religion, we just have to remember that he's a scientist. He's entitled to his opinion, but it doesn't mean that we should take him any more seriously than we do anybody else.
Well, we're going to go and take our last break. When we'll be back, we'll be wrapping things up. I'm Nick Peters with Deeper Waters Podcast, interviewing Dr. James Hannum today.
This is Mike Lacona. Nick Peters is my son-in-law, and I'm excited to announce his new podcast in which Nick will discuss and have guests on topics related to Christian apologetics and dealing with disabilities. Nick has already interviewed apologetic stars such as Greg Kokel and Rob Bowman, and I know of other stars he's in the process of inviting. So be sure to check out Nick's new podcast.
Check out CYIWorldwide.com. CYIWorldwide.com, home of Grok Radio. Free music downloads, advice, prayer, and support. CYIWorldwide.com. Do you grok?
And we're back with Dr. James Hannum. And if you're listening next week, we're going to have a brief interview with Alan Schlemon of Stand to Reason Ministries. We're going to be talking about Islam. We're looking forward to that one. We're getting back to our guest, Dr. James Hannum, today, talking about science and medieval period. Now, if there was this great relationship going on between science and the church and no conflict, it can be wondered, well, where did we get this idea from? And I think you'd likely agree that chances are it started with John Draper and Andrew Dixon White. Is that correct?
They certainly gave the idea that there's a conflict between science and religion, academic respectability. And Andrew Dixon White wrote an enormous book toward the end of the 19th century full of loads and loads of footnotes that looked very much like as if it was carefully researched history. And he produced his history, which purported to show that the church had held back science over the preceding centuries, and that the Middle Ages had been this dark and superstitious period where the church had prevented any kind of advance at all. But I think that was almost the end of the process of how this story of the conflict got going. It probably began with the Reformation, and after the Reformation, Protestant Christians were, of course, always on the lookout of ways to attack the Catholic Church. And so they, I think, made the mistake of equating their desire to attack the Catholic Church with producing a kind of critique of Christianity full stop. And in particular, they wanted to suggest that the Middle Ages had been a time where Christianity had been perverted from its original pure message. It was only with them, with Protestantism, that Christianity returned to the original path that it was supposed to have begun with at the time of the Church Fathers, and therefore the Catholic Church had been holding back and preventing Christianity from making any kind of progress in the meantime. And then in the 18th century, during the Enlightenment, French philosophers who had very understandable political issues with the ancient regime, the absolute monarchy of Louis XIV and XV and XVI, used the conflict between science and religion as a stick with which to beat the church, because the church in France at that time was very reactionary and was very closely aligned to the absolutist state. And it wasn't safe to attack the state directly. It wasn't really safe to attack the church directly. But if you went back in time and you told the story that the church had been holding science back, you could attack the church and the state indirectly by suggesting that it had always been very backwards and very much a stick in the mud. And then in the 19th century, science begins to get going, and it becomes something that people want to do professionally. And Thomas Huxley, often known as Darwin's bulldog, was a man who was a professional scientist. He came from quite a disadvantaged background, and he owed his position in life and he owed his professional prestige to science. And he was quite angry about the way that many scientists seemed to be nothing more than hobbyists, amateurs. And in particular, there were an awful lot of clergymen who were members of the Royal Society, the premier scientific club in London, who went around and collected butterflies and just didn't, he thought, seem to be allowing science to stand on its own two feet as a profession in its own right. So he wanted to detach the church from the scientific establishment. And for that reason, he too promoted this idea that science and religion were in conflict. And that, again, got given a great deal more impetus by the work of John Draper and Andrew Dixon White, so that by the beginning of the 20th century, everybody believed that science and religion were in conflict and the church had held back science. And it really wasn't until the 1980s that the contrary view began to be accepted in the academy once again with the work of historians like Edward Grant and David Lindbergh. Edward Grant, mm-hmm. very interestingly, it says in one of his books that he changed his mind over the course of his career, originally thinking that medieval science had been really something which had enjoyed very little progress at all, but as he studied it more and more, he realized that this hadn't been the correct conclusion, and in fact, medieval science had been tremendously important.
Mm-hmm. But this belief is still widespread today. In fact, I think you've done meticulous research at your own website, and this is a great chance for you to give that plug of that website, that people like Andrew Dixon White and others either are falsified information, or sometimes they even just went outright and made it up, didn't they?
Well, sometimes they must have done it. It's very difficult to understand how they could be saying what they were saying if they had actually done all the research that they claimed to have done. Because if they'd really done that research, they would have got to a different answer. And there are instances that appear in the work of Andrew Dixon White that nobody else has ever been able to discover. There was an instance of somebody being arrested for alchemy, and he named somebody in medieval France, but nobody else has been able to find out anything at all about this guy.
In fact, contrary to what people think today, one of my friends who works closely with JP Holding of Tectonics emailed me when he heard about what the show was going to be on today, and he's got it listed on Tectonics at tectonics.org/SEIM/SEINCEMONY.htm, a list of 1,600 biographies of scientists who are Christians. And this idea that there is some natural contradiction between the two, it really doesn't fit at all today, does it?
Well, not at all. I mean, there have been throughout history very many scientists who are Christians. There are very many scientists who are Christian today, and there are several very esteemed scientists in this country, in the UK, who are very devout believers. In fact, up until Darwin, pretty much all the most important scientists were really quite religious men. Darwin is about the first very important scientist who wasn't a particularly religious man.
Mm-hmm. So what are we to think about people like Richard Dawkins and others today, who do seem to use science as a way to go after Christianity? For instance, how Dawkins says, science flies you to the moon, religion flies planes into buildings.
Yes. Well, Richard Dawkins is clearly a gentleman who believes what he believes very seriously indeed. But I think we just have to see a lot of what he says as being polemic rather than argument.
Yes.
I think his famous book, The God Delusion, people suggest that was intended to be an argument for atheism. And I don't think it was. I think that Richard Dawkins isn't really trying to convert people to atheism. I think what he's trying to do, and I think he sort of says this in his book, is make people who are already atheists feel better about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think he worries that there just wasn't enough red meat
confidence
out there for atheists to read. And we have loads and loads and loads of devotional literature for Christians. If we feel... that we want to get in touch with our faith, we can pick up C.S. Lewis, and immediately we feel closer to God as a result. And I think really you have to look at The God Delusion as being devotional literature for atheists rather than being a rational argument. And I think everything that Dawkins does should be seen in that light. He is like a preacher trying to inspire his flock rather than a scientist who is trying to discover something new.
In fact, if we were being bluntly honest, what we need to say is that science and religion are sadly both just tools. And yes, science flies to the moon, but it also drops atomic bombs on cities. And yes, religion can be used to fly planes into buildings, but it was also used to build hospitals, and inspire love for your neighbor, and yes, even encourage modern science. The problem isn't so much religion or science, it's the problem's us.
I think that's true. I think that because we're sinners, everything we lay our hands on can go wrong, and that's the case with science, and it's the case with religion.
But suppose we've got someone listening, and they're saying, I'm still not really convinced. I still have my question. What would you say to the scientific mindset out there who says, I still think there is a conflict between science and religion going on?
Well, I think in the modern world, it's certainly the case that we have specific cases where certain kinds of religion disagree with certain kinds of science, and creationism
yes.
is an example of that. And there's no doubt that that is an instance of conflict. But if you look at the bigger picture, those kind of instances seem to be remarkably rare. And a lot of the examples of where there's supposed to have been conflicts between science and religion I've been discovered during my research and have explained in my book Genesis of Science. Those are myths. They didn't really happen.
Mm-hmm.
There's quite a lot of why people think there is a conflict between science and religion is simply misinformation.
Mm-hmm.
So although it's very possible... Sorry.
Well, maybe this, you can use this as an example. I think one of the great examples we have is this supposed debate between William Wilberforce and Huxley, where it was said that Wilberforce was just humiliated by Huxley, when in fact, whatever you think of Darwin's theory, Darwin himself admitted that Wilberforce gave an excellent critique of his work, in fact, and no one really remembers the debate the way that modern atheists today frame it. Is that kind of an example of what you're talking about?
Well, absolutely. And in fact, Wilberforce was pretty sympathetic towards Darwin. He wrote a review of The Origin of Species, which was friendly. It was critical, but it was friendly. He didn't really have a problem with evolution. His issue was, as it was with many people at the time, and something which took a while to be accepted, was the issue of human evolution, where human beings had come from. But it's interesting that even Huxley, who we think of being the arch-Darwinist, actually wasn't. Huxley totally rejected the idea that morality could have an evolutionary origin. He was really worried about the ethical implications of religion, survival of the fittest, nature, red in tooth and claw. That really worried him. And it's interesting that although he was someone who supported Darwin and did believe in human evolution, he wasn't willing to go all the way and totally accept evolution as the only explanation for the way that animals and humans behave.
Now, of course, I think also one thing you'd say to the skeptic out there who's listening, who's unconvinced, would be, well, go and get my book and read through it and see what you think about it, and by all means, check every footnote you want to.
Absolutely. I mean, if anyone does want to pick the book up, I hope they enjoy it. And I should say that it's very much written with the general reader in mind. It's not intended to be an academic book. It's intended to bring things which academic historians have discovered to a wider audience. And also, I'm on the internet. I'm on Twitter. I can be tweeted. I can be emailed. And I'm always interested to answer questions that people send me.
Well, before we do have to go, how about giving us some information about where you can be found in case there are people out there, and I hope there are, who want to know more about this?
Well, Genesis of Science is available on Amazon. I think it's available in bookshops. It can be ordered from bookshops. It's available also, I think, in quite a few Christian bookshops and ministries. There's also an audio book version which you can order as well if you prefer to listen to it rather than having to read it. There are even German and Dutch editions if that's the language you prefer to read it in. So it's quite widely available, and I think quite an entertaining read as well, though I say so myself.
And what about your website? Where can they find that at?
Well, my website is jameshannum.com, and on there are some articles which I've written on some other aspects of the history of science and the history of religion, for instance. An article about the witch trials and where the conflict between science and religion came from, and the Great Library of Alexandria, and what happened to all the ancient literature of the past. Is it true that Christians burnt it all? And of course, it isn't. Other kind of aspects like that.
Yeah, that's something that we have to stress on here is that, and I think that was with every guest, that there is no way we can really cover everything, and there are so many unanswered questions, because your book is filled with so many great people and inventions that it would take us several shows if we were to cover everything. So anyone should consider what they're hearing on here is just kind of like a small appetizer for those who want to give a fuller information.
Yes, yes, the book is definitely the main course, but it's great that we've been able to talk about so many different things over the last couple of hours, Nick.
Yeah, and I thoroughly enjoyed it, and as I was even telling my wife beforehand, I said, this is some information that really a lot of people haven't written on this aspect, and it seems to remind me every single time that I look at some of these kind of like axioms of atheism, things that are held to be, well, known by everyone, that any time I've really looked at a lot of these, they don't tend to stand up to scrutiny too well. And I think the more and more information we have coming out from further studies like this, the more we'll find that common knowledge is really common ignorance.
Absolutely right, yes. And that's something perhaps that science does teach us, that we should never just assume we know something before we've investigated it.
In fact, for the scientific listeners out there, and I mean, I'll be up front and blunt and say, I'm not a scientific listener. I'm interested in the history of science, but I can't discuss science as science, which is just fine. And your book doesn't require that kind of understanding in order to appreciate it. But for those of you out there who are scientific thinkers, then do exactly what you're supposed to do. Look at his book and follow the evidence where it leads and be open to the possibility that what he says could be correct.
Yes, absolutely. Thank you.
Well, we've only got about 3 minutes left here, so is there any other message that you would like to leave for our listeners before we wrap this all up?
Well, I think the last thing I would say just goes back to this idea that there has been this great conflict between science and religion, and I think every time you come across an example of this conflict, that the Pope banned the Zero or banned lightning conductors or excommunicated Halley's Comet, all the other ridiculous things that we hear that people still respond to me when I suggest that there really hasn't been this great conflict about Roger Bacon and other people who are allegedly persecuted by the Church. Every time you hear one of those things, I think you really have to say, well, what is the source for that? How do you know that? Because every time I investigated all those things I've just mentioned, I found that, in fact, the truth isn't that they're examples of a conflict. There may be cases where things turned out rather differently, or it may be cases where it's just a complete and utter myth and legend, for example, that the Pope tried to excommunicate Halley's Comet. Why on earth would a Pope try to excommunicate a comet? It's a ridiculous idea, and yet people believed it for years and years and years. I think we, therefore, when you do hear these sorts of stories, be a bit more skeptical than you might have been in the past.
Next week we have Aaron Schlemann on to talk about Islam, the book Genesis of Science. It's available on Amazon for Kindle at $11.99 and hardcover at $19.40. I encourage you to go out and pick it up today. It's certainly a great read. I thoroughly enjoyed it and found it very enlightening. And my final thanks to Dr. James Hannum for being our guest on such short notice, and hopefully we'll see you back here again sometime.
Thank you very much, Nick. It's been a great pleasure.
And this is Nick Peters, the Deeper Waters Podcast, reminding you, please be praying for my family with everything that's going on, and I will try and keep some updates going. But for now, I'm Nick Peters, signing off until next week.